17. Thank you to Pastor Nugens for giving me some time this summer to take a break from our series in Judaism. Also gave you a break, right? It's always good to get a little break. Familiarity breeds contempt, I hear, and so we didn't want you to be getting bored or worn out with Judaism, but we're back into it. Lesson number 55. We are still in the framework of Judaism. We've been looking at the law, and we have looked at so far in our 55 lessons the religious law, the business law, criminal law, family law, dietary and hygiene law, military law, and now we're on to our final category under the law, which we're just going to call general law. There are a number of laws, codes that I didn't know where to put, and so we'll call it general law. This is, again, an organic study. This is not something that you're going to find out there, so please don't worry about being right or wrong on whatever books are out there. This is just us going through it, kind of category by category. Under the general law, we've already looked at a few things. We've looked at laws pertaining to the authorities. That is a law that pertains to the leaders of the nation, and that's in Exodus 22 when Moses said, "Thou shalt not revile the gods nor curse the ruler of thy people." We looked at laws pertaining to the poor. God didn't want his people resting or twisting judgment just because somebody was poor. We looked at laws pertaining to the foreigner. God wanted the foreigner to be treated well, not to be oppressed, given Israel's background. We looked at the law pertaining to false gods. They weren't to talk about false gods, false religions. They weren't to dig deep into it. They were to keep it out and not address it. We looked at laws pertaining to the elderly that had to deal with a great deal of respect. And then we finished back at the end of June on laws pertaining to the body, in particular shaving the corners of the head, the corners of the beard, cutting the flesh that had a lot to do with mourning. And now we're going to look at laws pertaining to the kings. The Jewish law has a reputation of being quite rigid, doesn't it? And I think that's a fair reputation to give it. It was a very rigid system. It was designed to be a code that, if followed, it would breed success. If not followed, it would breed failure. And God gave them a lot to chew on. That being said, it wasn't so rigid that future changes in society would undo everything. It wasn't so rigid that there wasn't some liberties to make some future adjustments to societal structure. And if there were these future changes, that everything would crumble to the ground. That's what we're going to see here as we read this. God designed the law with the future in mind. He designed the law with human tendencies to change in mind. He designed it knowing what his people would eventually do. After all, he is God. He has the foreknowledge of everything to come. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, God says through Moses to the people of God, he says, "When thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me." We'll read on in a moment, but do understand the history of Israel at this point. Before Moses, there was no governing system over the Hebrews. Abraham was the beginning of the Israeli people. God called Abraham out of Ur. He comes into Canaan. God gives Abraham a covenant. This covenant would be perpetual throughout Abraham's generations. They would inherit the land. They would be God's chosen people. Eventually, the Messiah would come through the Israelites. But when God gave Abraham the covenant, he didn't give him a government. And so the Israeli governing system, if you would, from its inception, was a patriarchy. Abraham was the leader. He was the king. He was the priest. He was the father. He was the pastor. He was everything. Everyone in his family, which consisted of just Sarah at the time, looked to Abraham. Abraham would have Isaac. Isaac would look to Abraham. Abraham would pass on this covenant, pass on this leadership to Isaac. Isaac would have Jacob and Esau. Isaac would then die and pass on this leadership to Jacob. Jacob would have 12 sons. All those sons would look to Jacob. So it was a patriarchy. There was no governing system. There was no king. There was no prime minister. There wasn't a priesthood. Well, Jacob's sons go into Egypt. They become enslaved after the death of Joseph. Pharaoh now, the king of Egypt, provides the Israelites with a government. So their first government outside of the patriarchy would be the Egyptian government. And so by oppression, they would govern them. Over the course of 430 years, the Israelites would grow in number, become a greater nation. Their patriarchs were always Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they have tribal leaders, they had heads of their tribes, and so on and so forth, but they answered to Pharaoh. Well, we all know the story. Moses comes into Egypt and delivers the Israelites from Pharaoh's hand. They cross the Red Sea, they're in the wilderness, and for the first time in their existence, they don't have a patriarch that they're looking to as the leader of their nation. They have Moses, who is the deliverer, but they don't have a government system over them. The law provided that. Okay, the law provided a governmental system. You say, what was that? A theocracy. For the first time in Israel's history, they would be given the priesthood through the Levitical priesthood. And the Levites, the priests, they would provide the government structure for the nation of Israel. They would oversee the worship. They would oversee the judgments. They would oversee the decisions. They would oversee everything. That's why we've gone through some of these laws. They have to go to the priests. They would be the ones calling the shots, the ones doing what the nation needed it to do. The priesthood would keep the focus on God as supreme leader. Nowhere during the Mosaic Law, nowhere before the Mosaic Law, do we see God saying to the Israelites, you need to get yourself a king. The future for you, Israel, is a monarchy. No, it was always a theocracy. And yet, here we have in Deuteronomy 17, God saying, hey, at some point when you get into the Promised Land and you look around you and you notice all these nations have kings and you're going to feel bad, suck your thumb and want a king too, and you're going to say, let's give us ourselves a king. God says, when you do that, not don't do that. It's important we understand that God did not prefer a monarchy. He wanted a theocracy, but he didn't forbid a monarchy. He just said, if you guys decide to do that, I'm not telling you to do that. Quite frankly, I don't want you to do that. But if you decide to do that, there's no sin in doing that because a monarchy in itself isn't immoral in any ways. There's no threat to Judaism just because of a monarchy. That system is safe. I just don't like it, God essentially is saying. So if you do that, when you do that, I'm going to give you some advice, some counsel, and some commands that would come into play at that time. You say, why didn't God want a monarchy? Because he didn't want the people to focus on the crown. A monarchy is a potential problem for Judaism because a monarchy gives the people a person to look to instead of God to look to. You see, the priesthood, it was an organization, if you would. It was a tribe of people. Yes, there was a high priest, but there were priests, plural. And so the nation wouldn't be so quick to look to a person. They would be looking to a priesthood that would be pointing the nation to God. A king provides way too much temptation to become enamored with a person and the position. Look at our nation. I mean, we all look at the president like he's going to fix our problems, don't we? We all turn to the presidency every 4 years and say, you're a bad guy, you're not fixing our problems. Well, why would we expect one person to address all of our problems? But we do. It's just human nature. It's easier to blame the president than to blame God. You see, our problems in our country have been a lot less about politics and a lot more about morality. Bobblehead Christianity. Here we go. You know? Yeah. Yeah, we can blame the president all we want, but we need to blame God for the problems in America so that God can say, oh no, not my problem. You're just reaping what you sown. I'm not going to bless you because your iniquities have turned away these good things from you. So anyways, that's why God was not implementing a monarchy. I think there's a great lesson here in just this simple idea that God would allow something and put code in the event that that would happen, and I word it this way in my notes, we all need to recognize the difference between preference and commandment in our own governing. So God in his law has commandments, and then he has counsel, and he has counsel regarding his preference. And we as individuals, whatever position we have, or we're expressing our concerns or our our desires or even our expectations, especially as parents when we govern our children. We have to know the difference between what is our preference and what is a commandment. Those things that we say you must do, and if you don't do, they're disobedient. And then those things that we say, I wish you would do this, I wish as you get older you would choose these decisions, these are preferences of mine, counsel of mine. If you don't do this, it's not disobedient, it may be foolish, it's not what I would want for you, but it's a preference of mine. I think one of the best examples would be, parents can say to their kids, you're going to go to school, period. I am commanding you to go to school. If you don't go to school, if you skip school, if you, you know, try to get out of school, that's disobeying me. Unacceptable. Can't allow for that. That's a command. Here's a preference. While you're in school, I'd like you to take these classes. I'd like you to take the advanced math that you're qualified for. I'd like you to take the advanced science that you could take. You've been invited to take an advanced history class. I'd like you to do that. It'd be good for you. Be good for your future. You'll be better prepared for college. You're only young once. You might as well do it. It's free, by the way. Blah, blah, blah. But if the kid says, I really don't want that extra work, I don't want to do it, well, I think that's a mistake. It's foolish not to do that, but it's not a command. There's a difference. And we need to make sure that our children know that they have the liberty to make their own decisions in life. We're not going to dictate every single decision, everything they do. And when they don't do something we prefer, we shouldn't treat it like they disobeyed us. I think parents make a big mistake oftentimes by getting the command and the preference so close to each other that a child feels that if they wear a different color shirt, they feel guilty of some great sin. Because mom likes the orange one. Or dad likes me to pursue being a mechanic, and I don't want to do that, but I feel like I'm disobeying my father. Well, whoa, whoa, whoa. Preference over commandment. There is a great difference. God did not command a theocracy without a monarchy. He commanded a theocracy and said, you could add a monarchy if you want. Wouldn't do it, but you could. There's a difference between preference and commandment. We need to allow for liberty just as God did, some flexibility just as God did, and be prepared to guide them through that. Parents, we need to let our kids make mistakes when it comes to our preferences, our counsel, and be ready to guide them through that. That's exactly what God did. He says, if you want a monarchy, which I wouldn't do, but if you want a monarchy, here's what I'm going to tell you your kings have to do. I'm going to help you through that mistake of having a monarchy. Not a sin, just a mistake. The monarchy was a mistake in many ways for the nation of Israel in the future. But God prepared for that. God knew that would happen and worked it all out, in particular through the house of David. All right, so we're going to read verse number 14 now and verse 15 and mention a few things about kings. Verse 14 again. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. Verse 15. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. So God says, if you want a monarchy, if you want to be like all your neighbors, the peer pressure gets to you, you got to be cool like everyone else at school, you can go ahead and get those jeans, but here's what those jeans are going to look like. They're not going to be tight. They're not going to be short. So that's what God is doing here. He's saying, if you want to be cool like the kids in school, you can do this, but here are my new commandments in light of you not taking my preference. And for a king, if you want a king, you want to be cool in school, you can have a king, but first things first, I pick them. And parents, it's a good idea. Get your kids some clothes that are fashionable, that are stylish, so they don't feel like they're, you know, 400 years behind the times, but I pick them out. Right? Didn't that work? No? All right. God is saying, you can have a king, I pick them out. What is this? This is not excluding a monarchy, he's just saying theocracy over monarchy. He's saying, I choose who you get to have as the governor. This nation of Israel, it's It's always fascinating to me to read through the Mosaic Law in light of what happened just after leaving Israel. You think about the problems that came so quickly to the nation just outside of the Red Sea in the wilderness, at the foot of Mount Sinai. These people so quickly turned away from God. And when you look at the law and you think, wow, God just doesn't give them a lot of breathing room. Not really, because they proved that they can't handle it. They can't handle the responsibility that comes with governing themselves. At the foot of Mount Sinai, Moses is up in the mount with God, and what did the people do? They rushed to Aaron and said, hey, can you get us together and be our new leader? Because as for Moses, this man that led us out of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And Aaron says, all right, good deal. Give me some gold. We'll make a golden calf. We'll worship it and have a good time. You know what that was? A failed experiment of democracy. Right? The people put their vote in. We want Aaron over Moses. Aaron over Moses. They chose their leader. Their leader failed them by turning to idolatry so quickly after God just delivered them from Egypt. It's amazing. So should it surprise us when God says, all right, you want to be cool in school, you pick your king. No, I pick your king. Because you guys are really bad gauges of character. Aaron can't be your king. This didn't happen too long after that. So Exodus 32, they picked the wrong guy. The wrong guy led them to idolatry. This led to death, unfortunately. Fast forward just a little bit more time. They've gotten their way to the promised land. And God says to Moses, send 12 spies in to check out the land. So they do that. They come back, discourage the people. 10 of the 12 say, we can't go in. The people are so strong. We're so small. And right after that, the people said, pick us a man, and we will go back into Egypt. They wanted to choose a leader because Moses was a bad leader. Moses would lead them into the promised land. Trusting God doesn't work. And so we want a guy who will take us back into bondage in Egypt. The democratic vote at that time was to pick a man that would take them backwards instead of forward. So when it comes time for God counseling them 40 years later before they finally will go into the promised land, God says, I know. 40 years under theocracy is probably a burden to you. You're going to get jealous of all the monarchies. Pick a king as your form of government, a monarchy. But I'm going to pick the guy because you have proven incapable of picking the right man. A monarchy would not abolish the priesthood. Now, when they finally did choose a monarchy, which would have been after the time of the judges, Samuel was the final judge, the final good judge. His sons were vile, unfortunately, and the people said, we don't want your sons, Samuel, as our leader. We want a king. And you remember how upset Samuel got? He was very upset, and he said, fine, you want a king? Well, this is what's going to happen. And he just laid it out there. You're going to pay taxes. He's going to hire your women to be cooks. He's going to hire your men to be servants. So you're going to have to serve this man. You're going to pay taxes. But if you want it, fine. He calls rain down from heaven. I mean, it was not a pretty day. But God said, all right, I said you could have a monarchy. I choose the guy. Who did he choose? Saul. It was a moment that God chose a man, put him before the people, and unfortunately, he also failed. And that wasn't a bad choice from God. God chose a man with a free will who couldn't handle the power and the responsibility and the stress that came with being a king during a very heavy military active time. So, Saul fails the nation of Israel. What does God send Samuel to do? Anoint the son of Jesse, David. And from there on forth, God did not choose the king. He chose the man who should have sons to be the kings of Israel for the rest of Israel's history. So that's where this verse leads us into the future. All right, let's look at verse 15 again. Number two, not only should the king be God's choice in the event that the people chose a monarchy, but the king was to be Jewish. Verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. This was for obvious reasons. especially in a society where heritage and history meant so much. I believe still is the case here in America that we cannot choose a president who is not an American citizen, and that makes an awful lot of sense. That being said, this is a nation of many peoples, many ethnic backgrounds. We're the melting pot of the world, and for us, we have a lot of different cultures immersed into our citizenship. So we could have someone who is a citizen but has a lot of different background from their ancestors. Israel was not so. In Israel, you had to have a Jewish king. God knew this because a foreigner, a non-Jewish person, could hardly appreciate the Abrahamic covenant. And that was so special to Jewish people. It still is. To be a son of Abraham, a daughter of Abraham, going back to Abraham, Abraham was given the promise that makes us uniquely God's children, and it gave us uniquely the promised land, and we have this special bond with God, the God of Israel. And so a stranger that would be king would not appreciate that. He could very much minimize the Levitical priesthood. He could very much discourage following the Mosaic law because of that lack of connection and appreciation and not appreciating the history of Israel. I mean, the covenant that God gave at Mount Sinai was pretty impressive. The thunder, the smoking of the mountain, the people were terrified. They recognized what God had done for them and what he was offering them. A stranger would lack that appreciation. Think about the tragic history of Israel and how many times they were carried into bondage, into captivity. They were placed under what type of leaders? Kings, emperors, dictators. They were placed under pagan Gentile dictators. Life was not good for them under captivity. The only time they were under them is when their sins caused God to take from them their monarchy and to a great degree even their theocracy. You may wonder why when you get to the New Testament, the Jews tempted Jesus by asking him, is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar? Now, we may look at that from a covetous standpoint, this lifelong historic argument, is it right to pay taxes? But the question they were asking really goes back to the law. And the law said you cannot have a non-Jewish king over you. And so they were trying to trick Jesus into getting into some legal problem with the law because Caesar isn't Jewish. So should we pay taxes to a non-Jewish king? It has a foundation here in Deuteronomy 17. All right, verse number 16. Number 3, the king wasn't to multiply weapons to himself. Verse 16, but he, the king, the future king, shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. We look at horses very differently than the ancients looked at horses, right? We look at horses now as in Kentucky Derby, background pony or backyard pony, you know, a hobby, an art, a technique, an enjoyable pet, a creature that can be fun to have around and get to know and take care of. That is not how the ancients looked at horses. Horses were the ancient tanks of the day. So if you had a horse, you had a weapon for military might. It wasn't even the choice for travel. They would use camels for that. They would use donkeys for that. Horses were weapons. That's why when you read in Proverbs chapter 21, verse 31, the horse is prepared against the day of battle. Horses were battle tools. The second part of that verse is why God didn't want kings to multiply horses to himself. The second part of that verse is, but safety is of the Lord. God didn't want the future king to multiply horses to himself because he didn't want a future king to amass a military powerhouse in which the people wouldn't need to trust God, they would just trust their military. I would argue that's where we are here in America, and I am proud of our armed forces. I stand behind every branch of our armed forces. I am so proud to be an American when it comes to any conflict. I love America. I'm a patriot. I stand behind our military. I'm just, when I see them, I'm like, yeah, go get them. You know, I'm all about what they do. That being said, does America not trust more in our armed forces than we do in God? When there's a military conflict and nothing really gets close to us, but we all say, go get them, boys and ladies now, you know, go get them. Are we asking God to protect us? Are we relying solely on the Lord to give us victory? That's what God didn't want to happen to the Israeli people. Kings, unlike priests, would be far more apt to focus on the military. You think of a king, you think of castles. You think of kings, you think of horses. You think of kings, you think of chariots. You think of kings, you think of shields and swords. You think of military might. Kings, out of duty to protect their people, would naturally develop a strong military, which isn't wrong. But he didn't want the people to look to the king and his military before looking unto God. And so God said to the Israeli people, a future Jewish king was not to multiply horses. But I want you to look at that verse again and just notice a phrase. He says he shall not multiply horses. The next two words really help you appreciate it. He says, to himself. A king should not multiply horses to himself. In other words, he's amassing horses and weapons for his administration, for his job, for his responsibility in protecting his people. He is massing a military for his name, for his reputation, for his power. And that's what God did not want him to do. He also doesn't want a king to amass horses to himself because of the ties to Egypt. At the time that the law was given, Egypt was the military powerhouse of the Middle East. They had horses and lots of them. They had chariots and lots of them. That's why when you read about the Egyptian army following the Israelites into the wilderness to the Red Sea, there's so much meaning to their fear. They looked back, they didn't just see an army, they saw the Egyptian army. And when the army got into the Red Sea, it wasn't just some, you know, easy victory for God, oh, I'll just kill this army. It was the Egyptian army. And so when Moses sang his song about Pharaoh and the horse and his rider and the chariots being killed, it was saying God just beat the greatest army on the planet. And so when you get to a potential monarchy, God says, don't you go back to Egypt to get horses? I don't want my people looking back there as a means of getting their tools and their resources and their strength and their military to protect them. Whoa, I delivered you from Egypt. And you're going to go back to them to protect you? No way, Jose. These are the dangers of a monarchy. A theocracy wouldn't pose that risk. The prophet Isaiah addressed this problem of going back to Egypt when he said, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and stay on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. Why wasn't a monarchy a preference for the Lord? Because he didn't want people to look to the king. The king was never to replace God. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 10. Hold your finger here in Deuteronomy 17. This little minor detail in Moses' law is a hint to why God did not implement a monarchy any sooner, why he did not prefer it, and why a monarchy was dangerous. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse number 26, the Bible tells us about Solomon's very successful reign, a reign that God no doubt blessed, but a reign that got off track. And Solomon, verse 26, gathered together chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king at Jerusalem. Verse 28, and Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt, and linen yarn, The king's merchants received the linen yard at a price, and a chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and an horse for 150. Bummer. This is the first hint that Solomon was doing exactly what God didn't want him to do. And we'll talk about him more in the coming verses. Turn back to Deuteronomy 17. Hold your finger in 1 Kings chapter 10. Number 4, under the stipulations of a monarchy, the king was not to multiply wives unto himself. Verse 17, Moses writes, neither shall he, the king, multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Why wasn't a monarchy God's preference? Well, because kings have a tendency to get a lot of attention, don't they? I mean, we wouldn't know that outside of maybe looking at our democracy, and the president gets a lot of attention, doesn't he? But when you're the main man, when you're the one guy that everyone looks to that has power, prestige, and wealth, you get a lot of attention, and if you're a guy, you get a lot of attention from women. What woman doesn't want to be a princess? What girl doesn't want to grow up and be a queen? And so kings would get a lot of interest. God knew how dangerous the wrong woman could be to the right man. God knew how quickly a man's heart can be a target of flattery. God knew how easily a man's heart can be turned from the people to the princess, from his work of leading a nation to making himself feel good. Multiplying wives for any person is a sign of discontentment. It's a sign of self-absorption. And unfortunately, in the ancient times, it's a sign of status. Just as with building up the military. Go back to 1 Kings 11. You're close to there. Let's see if Solomon fits the bill for this. We already know he's bringing horses in from Egypt, something God said you shouldn't do. He was doing that to himself. You know Solomon's reign was not a time of war, right? Why was he building the military up? Because it was all about this thing, the crown and this big fat head, unfortunately. Verse 1, but King Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, that's why you know he was crazy, princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. That's what God said not to do. Verse number 4. There's a whole other lesson in this verse. It says, for it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after God's. Can I put a little pause here and go off on a really short bunny trail about dating lost people or marrying a lost person? I'll say this for those of you single people. There is danger in having a lengthy relationship with a lost person. Now, I entertain that a short relationship in which the gospel is the focus is in itself in many ways acceptable because you're trying to reach somebody with the gospel. But I will say this, if you're engaged in a long-term relationship that is any more than a friendship with a lost person, it may work for a while, but eventually, the longer it goes, your heart, not his heart, your heart, not her heart, will be the one that turns. Solomon was able to, for many years, have all of these pagan wives and still be devoted to God and be strong in his convictions and faithful to the Lord God of Israel. It says, when he was old, then his heart fell apart. So, I'm just giving you some advice, young people. If you find yourselves in a relationship with a lost person, keep it incredibly short. Put a time frame on it. Come see me so I can hold you accountable. The longer it goes, the more likely it will be he will pull you out of church. She will pull you out of God, not the other way around. Okay? Verse number 4, for it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem. And he built one for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned away from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. Tragically, Solomon proved why God didn't want a king to multiply wives unto himself. It took a while, but eventually these women turned his heart from the Lord, and a good nation with a bad king would eventually become a bad nation. When you're a king, it's a lot bigger than you. It's about the people. And when you turn the people's hearts from God, it's not a good place to be in with God himself. Now, this phrase, to himself, go back to Deuteronomy 17. We know that the king should multiply horses to himself. We know now that the king should multiply wives to himself. That phrase, it tells us where the violation of these laws rest. If a king had a lot of horses and a strong military, that didn't make him a violator or a lawbreaker. If a king had multiple wives, it didn't make him a lawbreaker. And I'm going to get to next week, if a king had a lot of money, it didn't make him a lawbreaker. The difference is, the problem is, when a king gets himself a military, when the king gets himself a lot of wives, and when the king gets himself a lot of wealth, that's when he's breaking the law. It's a man doing all this for himself versus God blessing a man with those things. Point in case is David. Did David have a great military as a king? Absolutely. Who gave him that great military? God gave him that great military. God gave him the people. God gave him the strategy. God gave him the wisdom. God gave him all that stuff so that David could accomplish great things for God. Did God give David his wives, plural? Or did David go out and get them? Did he multiply them to himself? I know this is a tough question to answer because we don't want to think God in any way, at any time, condones polygamy. You going to take a stab at this, Doug?
Yes. When he committed adultery with Bathsheba, God told him that I gave you these wives. You could have asked and I would have given you more.
Yeah, we don't like that, but that's exactly what God said. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 12. This is after David committed adultery with Bathsheba. God comes to him through Nathan the prophet and says this, I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, God says, I would moreover have given unto thee such and such things. David's polygamy was not David multiplying wives into himself. Now, we can talk about that in another topic and marriage and whatnot. God's original intent was one man, one woman. But in this case, God says, I gave you the wives you had. I think he had two, maybe three. I think he had three. But he wanted a fourth one that he shouldn't have. So he was bringing Bathsheba into his life. God was not bringing her into his life. The key is not success being a problem for a king. It's when a person goes out and pursues success at the expense of governing the people. It's all about status. God knew as a monarchy, you're competing with your neighbor. I got more money. I got greater military. I got more wives. I've got more than you, and I'll beat you, and I'm the greatest of all of them. And listen, that's what testosterone does for a lot of guys. Put a crown on his head, just makes it worse. And God did not want the people to put their trust in princes, their trust in men. He wanted them to put their trust in God. Theocracy over monarchy. God allowed for a monarchy. Wasn't his preference. But he gave them certain stipulations that if they had a monarchy, they were to follow. If you have any questions, see me after class, or we can discuss them next week. We'll go through the final few things in Deuteronomy 17. We're running a little late, so let's close in prayer. I'm going to ask Tom Nosbusch if you would please close in prayer.